Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month, no commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Eye Studio with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. We are here on quite a fast-moving news day. So this is just to say that at the time of recording, Keir Starmer's Prime Minister and Peter Mandelson hasn't been brought back in again for another job. I've come up with a new principle of political life. You know, the thing of the Peter principle, where everyone is employed 1 degree more than they should be. This is the Peter Mandelson principle, where you come back one time after you really should be.
One time too many.
One time too many, yeah.
I would say three is three times too many.
Yeah. I suppose we're going to start off with how this whole thing unfolded in the first place. Mm-hmm. Were there any signs, possibly, that making Peter Mandelson ambassador to the USA was a bad decision?
Yes, the two previous resignations for basically exactly the same sort of thing, which is having slightly suspicious relationships with wealthy people.
Is right. How much due diligence you actually need to do, because you can pretty much guarantee that if you give Peter Mandelson a job, he's going to be in with some dodgy, very, very rich person. He's not going to declare that to the people he should have been. He's going to open up some sort of back channel to do some kind of dodgy favour for them, and he's going to have to resign pretty quickly and make everyone look stupid. I mean, it's not hard to work out, is it?
I mean, I'm not saying that I was underwhelmed by this scandal, but there has been a lot of this is the greatest scandal since the Profumo affair, it's the scandal of the century, whatever. And I kept running into my, but this is what Peter Mandelson does kind of filter. Yeah. And I also wonder whether or not for people who aren't so tuned into the Westminster bubble and the soap opera aspect of it, the way that it's affected now, Keir Starmer's now former Chief of Staff Morgan McSweeney, this was just a kind of like more sort of snouts in the trough kind of. I put it on a par with maybe MPs' expenses, perhaps, as the most similar scandal that, of the kind, which is, I think it will have validated a lot of people's prejudice about the kind of thing that they thought politicians were all up to anyway.
I know there's an element of it which is very much scorpion stings frog shock, but there is also an element where we were promised all sorts of boring process, and we were promised a politics that treads lightly on everyone's lives, and we don't appear to have that.
I still cannot believe anybody's surprise. I've made a point about the cover about Beatrice and Eugenie being sold off to Epstein, which we made a long time ago, but when he went on that yacht with Osborne and Deripaska, Private Eye ran a cover and we put in as many puns as we could at the time. I feel sleaze sick, every Mandy for himself, bankers away, Corfu, what a stink. I mean, it's not as though whenever Mandy did anything involving rich people, no one noticed. How can he have gone through? And this is, that scandal's not mentioned in the top three, which are all...
Well, he didn't have to resign over that one. It was one of the rarities, wasn't it?
and you ask yourself, why not? But it did happen, and everybody knew, everybody in politics knew, what happens when you appoint Mandy. And they did it anyway.
Not to, I know this is my area of specialist interest and or personal psychological scarring, but the Labour psychodrama of this is quite worth revisiting, because essentially the series of events is this. Keir Starmer is elected in 2015, having been a very successful human rights lawyer, but fundamentally fairly apolitical. And he moves his way through the Labour ranks by essentially attaching himself to Brexit, which he was Shadow Brexit Secretary. And that's a really useful place to be in with the membership, because they were fervently far more pro-European than Jeremy Corbyn, at the same time that they absolutely loved Jeremy Corbyn and were very resistant to people from the centre and the right of the party having a go at Corbyn. But this was the one issue, actually, that Corbyn was not as one with the membership on. Mm. So when you get to that leadership election in 2020, I went to see Keir Starmer do his hustings, and you would not have thought you could really put a cigarette paper between him and Corbyn. That's the way he presented it. He thought Corbyn had been a bit soft on anti-Semitism, that had come up on the doorsteps, and he actually wished that he'd been more, you know, repellent of Brexit, both of which were kind of okay with the membership, but he did not present himself as this radical departure. Mm. But what then subsequently happened is, through Morgan McSweeney, he kind of bought in this entire agenda that was the one in which they won such a big majority last year, which was essentially appealing to white working class voters, people who might have been Labour to Reform switchers, hero voters, they called them, whatever it was. Mm. But in order to kind of staff that, when the gravity of the party was still somewhere in the Corbyn to Ed Miliband soft left zone, they ended up bringing in a lot of Blairites, right? And I think this is one of the things, as we're recording this, Tim Allen has just gone from Downing Street as Executive Director of Communications. He was only brought back in September, a Blair veteran. We've talked before, you mentioned Alan Milburn brought in to do health, a Blairite veteran.
Jonathan Powell.
Jonathan Powell in National Security. Yeah. And, you know, this other person who I think will maybe is a landmine for the future, Matthew Doyle, who was a comms person in the Blair era, brought back to do comms for Keir Starmer, has just been ennobled by him and is facing questions about whether why he kept supporting a guy who had been charged with looking at child sexual abuse material and then ran against Labour as an independent. And the common...
This is not Epstein, this is another
this is another paedophile, just to keep tracking if you're playing at home. But one of these issues is the fact that they essentially, what is the Starmer project? Mm. They just bought in Blairism as a way of staffing up roles, because they're just, in their long time in opposition, lost all their institutional memory. So you're getting a kind of, I guess for you two who were in a private eye through the Blair era, this is a sort of bizarre déjà vu, right?
Names
it's all
turning
happening
up.
Again.
Yeah, yeah, Roger Little suddenly we're talking about again. Remember him? He was the one that was hosting these Sunday night do's with Mandelson and various other people. You know, he's yet another name that was knocking around when I first started at the magazine. It is extraordinary.
I cannot believe there's nobody else alive in Britain who couldn't do the job better than people who worked for Blair in a very previous government. Why? Why would you let Mandelson vet candidates? Of all people, why would you let Mandelson do anything? It's still utterly beyond me. But yes, I gather you're heading towards the centre. You need some people who've done things before. But do you need people who've done things before very badly?
This is the greatest mystery about Mandelson, though, isn't it? Because he's always had and maintained this reputation as being this great PR spinner and this fantastic person who can, you know, work behind the scenes and achieve amazing things. What all he's ever done is make people dislike him quite intensely and turn himself into a symbol of corrupt politics repeatedly.
I think there is something quite attractive, and as a political journalist you have to be honest about it, about A, people who are really great sources and they've got a lot of really good gossip, but also people who absolutely love politics and love the game of politics. One of the problems, I was at the New Statesman during the Ed Miliband reign, and he patently disdained it, and politics was sort of beneath him. Why is everybody just plotting always and briefing, and oh, it's so terrible. And I think Starmer has that view too. So therefore it is... as a journalist, sort of more refreshing to spend time with people who absolutely love, like the George Osbornes or Ed Balls, people who just...
Gove.
Michael Gove is a very good example. So I think from the point of view of journalists who work in those circles, not only are those people very good sources of information, but like you, they enjoy the personal drama versus your kind of Gordon Browns, your Keir Starmers, who are trying to see themselves as aloof from it.
I think the problem with that probably is that 99.9999% of people in the country aren't political journalists and are actively repulsed, a bit like Ed Miliband and I think Keir Starmer, by that sort of politics. So doesn't really help anyway.
There has been a slight change of line, I'd say, from Mandelson as this story has evolved. I mean, we should remember he was sacked in September after a previous batch of emails was released. He's issued an apology, and I'm quoting here, to the women and girls who suffered. His previous line when he was asked about this by the Financial Times was, it's an FT obsession and frankly you can all fuck off.
That is a change of line.
It is a change of line.
PR genius, really good at spin.
But I suppose the question is, and I know the week is going to play out with whether these files are going to be released showing what was known when Mandelson was being vetted for the job, how the decision was made. The Peter files, if you like.
But his line, and I think this is very important, is that everybody else had said, how could I possibly know this? I didn't know Peter that well. this line was repeated by Peter Mandelson. How could he have known about Jeffrey Epstein? He had no idea who he was. And at that point, even the dimmest of political journalists thinks, I'd better jump ship.
Mm. Mm.
I mean, there was a very funny piece about the Times' attitude. The Times ran a very pompous leader saying, who on earth thought that Mandelson should be trusted and why? And then someone pointed out, well, you put him on your election podcast and you invited him in to talk to your journalists. The very brilliant Simon Childs writing. It is a bit of a point. You can't thunder when you've had this person on Times Radio, on your podcast. Why did you put him on? And if you say, I put him on because he's really interesting, he's got good gossip, you say, that's their line. What's your line?
But the line is, it is all the way up to Epstein, is I was lied to about this. So Mandelson says he was completely deceived by Epstein when he was visiting the island or the houses. He never saw any young girls there or anything like this.
Except there were two Swedish women there in one particular email. So either he's blind or being homosexual deprives you of sight, which is a new analysis.
That was the line, wasn't it? He knew nothing about it because he's gay, so he wasn't involved in that sort of thing. And then the email comes out of him talking about, oh, hey, you're out of prison now. We'll celebrate with some strippers called Liberty and
Modesty. But also in the birthday book, which came out last year, there's a line, there's pictures of him with women, overage as far as we can tell, but there's a line about how there was a man called Jeffrey who would turn up with some interesting friends. So there's the Epstein files are full of references like that to his harem, to you and your girl.
So this is the thing, Mandelson's line is, I couldn't possibly have known, and you can judge for yourself whether how likely that is.
Sorry,
but the line of the Labour team is, well, Mandelson lied to us when we were vetting him. You know, he said that the relationship was over.
But this isn't how vetting works. You don't say, are you in any way dodgy? They reply, no, of course I'm not. And then you say, thank you very much indeed. That's very kind of you.
You say you have to ask other people as well.
Or just read some papers. Or,
can I just point out...
Or indeed magazines, come on, make that very clear.
On that note, what might have been wise for everyone involved would be to read Private Eye. I mean, it's good advice for anyone at any time. But this is Slicker writing on the 30th of March 2009. So this is very, very shortly after Peter Mandelson is brought back into the government by Gordon Brown to serve as Trade and Industry Secretary. But effectively, sort of number two in the government. He was very much above sort of Alistair Darling, the Chancellor, in the pecking order. Slicker writes, in uncertain times, government ministers need all the expert help they can get, which may explain the surely fanciful suggestion that Business Secretary Lord Mandelson has been discussing with American money manager Jeffrey Epstein the new Obama administration and new powers on Wall Street. Last July, Epstein began serving an 18-month prison sentence in Florida after pleading guilty to soliciting sex from underage girls as young as 14. Multi-millionaire Epstein, also a friend of Prince Andrew and ex-President Clinton, has been on day release from the Palm Beach County Jail since October and so is available to meet and speak by telephone to friends. But it is surely too absurd to imagine that a British government minister would be talking to a jailbird, so these suggestions cannot be true. 30th of March 2009.
Wow.
Was that a case of sort of lawyer-induced sarcasm? So I think of the tone of that. I mean, that can't possibly be happening because...
Very possibly. I mean, he followed up, Slicker followed up again a couple of years later. So this is 2011, which is when the Epstein story sort of starts to get slightly wider circulation. He points out that it's suggested Mandelson contacted Epstein while he was on day release from a Florida prison to see whether he could help smooth the way for the then business secretary to contact leading Wall Street banker Jamie Dimon, chief executive of JP Morgan Chase, to discuss important financial matters, which is exactly the stuff that was coming out in the emails last week about Mandelson suggesting to Epstein that JP Morgan should mildly threaten Alistair Darling, the then Chancellor, over the proposed bankers' bonuses ban.
Right.
So it's all there.
It's all there.
It's all in the eye.
As Helen says, it may not be the biggest scandal ever, but suggesting government policy should be shared and influenced by major paedophiles is probably a bit new, isn't it?
I think in terms of how high it goes as well. I mean, we were saying literally he was pretty much second in command in the government. The Profumo affair, which this is being compared to, there wasn't even any accusation, I don't think, that Profumo had leaked anything via his various girlfriends. It was just the fact that he was sleeping with Christine Keeler at the same time that she was sleeping with a Russian spy. I mean, in terms of actual leak stuff, it tended to be very sort of low-down people. Usually the Ministry of Defence was the kind of the leakiest place, but it was sort of low-down civil servants. This was actually the second most powerful man in the country, who was quite prepared to discuss market-sensitive information, confidential documents, and share them with... share them with anyone, but share them particularly with an American paedophile does seem quite major.
And the line that Andy establishes that everyone lied to everyone, Peter Mandelson voluntarily handed over the information straight away and then lied to the Prime Minister. So it's not just passive.
I suppose the thing I'm interested in is at what point does believing you're being lied to by someone who is a proven liar become culpable? I mean, it seems
possible. The Cretan paradox.
It's the Cretan paradox. It seems plausible that the only world leader to be brought down by the Epstein files is Keir Starmer, someone who, as far as I can tell, would absolutely never have consorted with anyone like Epstein, someone who seems, you know, pretty sort of square.
And prosecuted quite a lot of people like Epstein.
Prosecuted people like this. I mean, human rights lawyer. This is extraordinary, isn't it? You know, I know Donald Trump is named thousands of times in the files, and apparently this just cuts no ice at all in the USA.
I mean, I think you have to look at it in the context of the fact that quite a lot of the parliamentary Labour Party think that Keir Starmer is a lemon. The scandal is one thing in itself, but a bit like, you know, who really outside of nerds like us remembers the Chris Pincher scandal, right? Mm. In terms of doing for Boris Johnson. But it was finally the accumulation of a lot of people thinking, we're better off without you than with you. Right. And so I think that's, you have to see it as part of that. I know what you mean. It does seem odd that so few consequences have been suffered by anybody in America. A few people have lost, you know, some TV gigs and some administrative stuff in US universities. Mm. Like, there has been some collateral damage. But in terms of the political scandal, the fact that Donald Trump fell out with Jeffrey Epstein in the 2000s before all these emails occur, and the fact, I suspect, that this was a man who used to fax mean things to his enemies really quite late into the 90s, I'm not sure he'd ever really got to grips with email, just means that actually Trump has sort of escaped this. But there's also the fact that he's elected president for a four-year term. There's really no way to get rid of him. So it's just not that live question in the way. And I felt like about a week ago, there was just this kind of scent of blood in the air, essentially, from the lobby, and that they just thought, hang on a minute, we've got him. And at that point, it always becomes very unpleasant. Actually, George Osborne and Ed Balls were talking about this in their podcast, and George Osborne did this thing where he said, you know, I never like this bit when you see the sort of hunting pack mentality. And I thought, well, I bet you should, having been on the end of it a couple of times. But then both of them ends up saying, I was shocked by the bit where you would be in government and you would just press forward on your email from the Treasury onto someone else. I think that's the bit that even people who thought they, and in the case of George Osborne, knew Mandelson quite well, actually Ed Balls in a sort of frenemy kind of way, but that I think people were genuinely shocked by that. Even, and I don't think that was fake shock. I think that was real shock, actually, that it was worse even than they'd thought.
Saying we're not remotely surprised that he'd consort with a paedophile after conviction, but this email forwarding thing is outrageous.
Yes, I mean, genuinely, right. Yes. On the basis that Lord Mandelson has always sort of delighted in this reputation of, like, the Prince of Darkness and whatever it might be. And his lobbying firm had a group of people whose Wikipedia pages have got very long controversies sections, right? Like, this is right. Kind of, this has always been his shtick. But I think that the word that Keir Starmer used was betrayal. And I think there are lots of people within the political class who do feel like that this is a betrayal. This is so outrageous that you just wouldn't have comprehended that anybody would not know that this was just, you should never do this.
Mm. I mean, equally, in terms of some patterning on it, I mean, you talk about his lobbying firm, his Global Council. I mean, absolutely secretive about what clients he was representing there. Well, still, right up until last week, serving as a member of the House of Lords, a member of Parliament, wasn't he, Ian?
And he claimed that the rules did not apply to him as a peer, that he did not have to disclose who these clients were that his lobbying firm lobbied for. And as you would expect, everyone a wrong'un. The list is unbelievable.
Even Sauron Technologies Limited.
Emperor Palpatine.
LLC.
Yeah, absolutely. Nuclear South African tobacco. You name it, they're all in there. And it was, again, this is this old hiding in plain sight business. I don't know how many pieces Richard Brooks wrote for us about Mandy's lobbying firm, but it was this area between business and politics. I mean, that's described on their mission statement. You think that's the area we don't want. Mm. We want politics and we want business. That's and cool. We do not want you.
It was helping clients see opportunities in politics. I mean, it's pretty blatant in terms of one of those opportunities in politics, of course, was he hosted a dinner for Palantir, Peter Thiel's company, with a load of NHS bosses just before they picked up an enormous NHS data contract in 2023. That was one of Richard's stories.
I mean,
there's an awful lot more of these as well.
And the idea that this was a good person to have in charge of your American embassy. And I do not buy this argument that they all say, well, it was high risk, low something appointment. It was a very high risk, no possible benefit appointment. I mean, the diplomatic service is not short of people who can go in and suck up to foreigners. That is part of the job. You know, this isn't a new observation. And you don't have to have Mandelson to do it.
So you don't buy the we needed a swamp creature to be in the swamp line.
Previous ambassador did a perfectly good job.
Right.
Why appoint a political appointee?
I think that was one of the many things that has pissed off the PLP, because that Karen Pearce was well liked, respected, seemed to be getting on with the job. There was no black marks against her record, and they parachuted in Peter Mandelson essentially because he was a mate of Morgan McSweeney's. And I think that's maybe part of the rage that Keir Starmer's feeling. Is I think he feels he was sort of duped into this, but he's the one with his name. I was going to say his name above the door, unless his name's Ten. That's not true. But ultimately, he's the Prime Minister. That's he is the ultimate decider. And the other thing it really spoke to was a sense that I've been hearing for coming up for 2 years now about the sense of a kind of little boys' club clique in Number 10.
Right.
And, you know, there's lots of women working in Number 10. Starmer's two new chiefs of staff, the ones acting, are both women, for example. But there was a feeling that there was a kind of little group of people who just got this sort of stitched up in amongst themselves. Mm. And I think that's the Karen Pearce thing spoke to that, is that particularly the women's PLP were like, hang on a minute, you've got rid of this very well-qualified woman in order to put in a very dodgy man. There was a kind of, what's that all about, actually?
Because there are no terms. It wasn't as if she was coming up to the end of a set term as the ambassador. You just get appointed and then...
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The way that people defended it at the time was essentially, like, MAGA is horrifically corrupt. Why don't we send over someone who won't make them feel ill at ease?
But, I mean, isn't the lesson of the past 6 months that sending people who are a bit straight into battle against Trump, like Mark Carney, works? And the people who stand up to him get results. The people who don't, our brilliant China deal. Not only have we got nothing at all, but Jimmy Lai goes to prison for 20 years. Oh, that was good. That's diplomacy working well. The whole premise of putting Mandelson in is nonsense.
Private Eye does, we should say, feature in the Epstein files, doesn't it? Yes.
Yes, and it's not me on a plane. it's a story found by Robbie Griffiths and Adam about... a lawyer. Tell us about him.
Paul Tweed. Yes, yeah. Who's been written about quite a lot in the eye. He's very keen on his job, defamation lawyer, shall we say. Let's describe him that way. And he was retained by Epstein for a while, although he's been very clear, like many people, to say this week that actually you knew nothing about him and didn't stay with him for very long. He wouldn't take his legal advice. So he stopped representing him in 2011 after he'd come out of prison for the first time. But yes, he took great issue with the Private Eye cover that we were discussing, the Beatrice and Eugenie. It was about the time the first of many stories came out about Fergie taking money from Jeffrey Epstein, who she seems to have treated as a sort of cash machine, really, doesn't she? Whenever she was in trouble, which was quite often, just kind of said, any suggestions? And he would wire her some money. But Paul Tweed took great offence at this cover and suggested to Epstein that it was a great affront and that legal action should be taken, not, in fact, against us, but against Sarah Ferguson at the time, who he thought was damaging Jeffrey Epstein's reputation. So,
And then the second mention was, it was Peter Mandelson, who was sending an email to Jeffrey Epstein saying, I think you're going to need a good libel lawyer. Again, in reference to the Private Eye cover and the story that Fergie had herself released. So there is a sense in which revenge is being served as a very cold dish around here. But that's why we put in the briefs joke. Because you said, well, you suggested to Epstein he needed a lawyer. We reckon you're going to need a good lawyer.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money. But nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Right, we're going to be staying with this story because it seems to be quite a big one.
Good insight, Andy.
Thank you.
That's I'm going to
start
sense.
That again. Yeah. All right. We're going to be staying with this story. Before we do that, there is one other seismic news story that I think we should cover, which is that this podcast proudly lost in its category at last week's Political Podcast Awards. I didn't see you three at the event. You were all busy. But I got to go and hang out with George Osborne, Ed Balls and others, who won big.
I was just going to say, all the people who knew Mandelson very well won awards. Or have you got to have stayed on a yacht with him? What's the exact criterion?
Well, I just want to thank the judges of that the whole competition who did a brilliant job. They were Anne Alexander, Liam Conlon MP, Gregor Poynton MP, Steve Race MP, Tom Rutland MP, Baroness Anne Jenkin, Deborah Mattinson, Harry Quilterpinner, and someone called Lord Ben Houchen. Who I don't think we realised was on the judging panel, and we might have saved ourselves the email.
How on earth did we not win?
Matt, the producer, and I just looked at each other and thought, well, we'll have a nice meal. And we did.
He's got no style, though, because the cool thing to do in that situation would be to give the award to your enemy in a sort of like, ha ha ha, I've... Because he's, like, he's won, hasn't he, in the sense of, like, in, we're talking about scandals that we private eye point out a lot and no one does anything about. He could just be like, ha ha, maybe you can frame this next to your many, many, like, reams of coverage about my dealings.
Well, yeah. Good point. Well, that's an idea for you next year, Ben. So, anyway, sorry, we should come back to the big winners of the night, George Osborne and his close personal chum Peter Mandelson, and the fallout from that story. Are there any stories that you think have not received the prominence they should have that came out in the last week, which have slightly been overwhelmed by political drama and, you
what,
know,
stuff from the Epstein files?
Stuff from the files, yeah.
Okay, well, this I think is very important. This is a statement from the General Osteopathic Council, which seems to have otherwise gone unreported. It says, we are aware of media reports that the husband of Peter Mandelson, Reinaldo Avila da Silva, was in receipt of funds from Jeffrey Epstein to fund an osteopathy course in the UK in 2009. Reinaldo Avila da Silva did not graduate from an osteopathy course and has never been registered with the General Osteopathic Council. Therefore, he is not able to practice osteopathy in accordance with the law within the UK. If he's poised with his hands over your spine at this moment, get off that table. I mean, that was one of the bizarre details, because this was the point where Mandelson was still talking to the press, and he said, well, I was just under the impression that this £10,000 that was given to his then-partner, now husband, was a sort of bursary, and that Jeffrey was just a very charitable guy who handed out these bursaries. And so, if you're handing out charitable bursaries, you probably don't give them to people who have recently stepped down as an extremely important cabinet minister and have quite a bit of cash already, do you?
No, there's probably some sort of means testing that goes on.
He just loves spinal realignment, okay? A man has got to have a hobby. So we're having all this discussion about Keir Starmer as, you know, former director of public prosecutions. There's another former director of public prosecutions who I think has got some questions to answer, which is Ken McDonald. So there's a very upsetting case of a Norwegian student who back in the 2000s was found raped and strangled, having left a club and got in a taxi with the son of a Yemeni billionaire. So her name's Martin Vik Magnusson and his name's Farouk Abdulhak. She was found 2 days later in the basement of this of his apartment block, by which time he had got on a plane to Cairo and thence to Yemen in his father's private jet. The Met decided there wasn't enough to charge, basically. I've been trying to get him back to Britain ever since. He confessed to the BBC that he said it was a sex game gone wrong, which is a defence that's often used in situations like this. But there are emails from the billionaire father to Jeffrey Epstein about a meeting that he had with Ken McDonald, which says Ken McDonald was paid £20,000 for a consultancy, about how they might possibly facilitate the return of this kid to Britain and make this case it was just a sex game gone wrong.
Can I check, this meeting proposed was after McDonald's time as Director of Public Prosecutions?
Yeah, yeah. He's working for Matrix Chambers at this point, so you can find it all if you search for Matrix Chambers in the files. But it was arranged, essentially. He said, you know, as a lawyer, you end up meeting lots of people with, you know, with checkered CVs. But nonetheless, I found this, you know, there's a reference to the fact that, you know, Ken McDonnell was helpful advising him because he'd be dealing with the current DPP, i.e. he'd be brokering the terms under which this kid would come back to Britain and face the music. And it's just the thing that got to me about all of this, a really horrible story about a poor dead woman who, you know, whatever happened, she's not, you know, she's never coming back. There's a whole life that would have been lived there. And at the end of one of the emails about this back and forth between the Yemeni billionaire and Epstein, it ends after this discussion of what's going to happen with how was the Caribbean, and it's like they're having this chit chat about, like, you know, how's life on your yacht, in between the discussion about the death of this young woman. And that, to me, just really, you know, I think a lot about that line, that F. Scott Fitzgerald line at the end of Great Gatsby, about they were careless people, they broke people and things and retreated back into their vast carelessness. And that, to me, is an example of it. You're discussing somebody that your son killed, whether he did that culpably or as an accident, and you're also just catching up with, how's the holiday going on? Like, was the weather nice? Did you get any good snorkeling in? It seemed unbelievably callous to me. And as I say, Ken McDonald's made a statement about it, but I don't think that reflects very well on him, frankly.
And, I mean, this is just one of the things that you've noticed. The amount of stories in the files that are buried underneath there, because we're just doing the politics and who's up and who's down at the moment. It is incredible how much there probably is yet to go in these millions of files.
The thing that's interesting about these files, whether or not you're looking at criminal wrongdoing in all these cases, and obviously you're not in all of them, you are looking about here's a really grim insight into the way that this bit of the world works, essentially.
Yes. Well, it's a claim that was made a lot by the MAGA movement, was that society was being run by elite paedophiles. It now doesn't look quite so absurd, unfortunately. I mean,
they thought it was happening from a pizza parlour in Washington. That's where they went wrong.
Yes, but
apart from that, they were on the money.
Yeah.
Can I also say, you just find out things that would have been really helpful to know a long time ago. So in a casual exchange of emails, we find out that Ghislaine Maxwell derived her enormous wealth from some secret trust funds left to her by her father. Oh, good. So the public money in Britain given because he'd stolen all the money from the pensioners, our money given to bail them out, could easily have been paid by Ghislaine Maxwell out of these secret trust funds that weren't secret to her friends in New York. Everybody is the poorer.
It was literally, it was 100 million, I checked, 100 million in compensation was paid by the government to the 32,000 former Mirror staff who had their pensions stolen by her dad. Whilst obviously he was stashing this money away. Her total net worth in 2013 was apparently estimated by JP Morgan, it's them again, they're always in the world of the files, 10 million. Yeah. So the idea was, I think, up until now, that was the attraction of Epstein for her, wasn't it? That he was funding her all the way. But no, turns out...
Yes, and it was this poor, sad family, the two brothers of whom obviously took me to court for contempt of court during the process, and I have no beef about that. But for younger listeners to the podcast, Maxwell did sue Private Eye. Robert Maxwell sued us on the grounds that we said he was stealing from his own pension fund. And then he died, but not before he'd stashed enough away for her not to have to live with the world's most famous paedophile. I mean, it is completely...
Just as a note for Peter Mandelson, if you're listening, that's how you declare interest. Yeah, yeah, that's how you say what you...
There is an online phrase that punish the villains is actually quite a good electoral mantra. You know, it's quite a powerful saying. Should we punish the villains? It's a good idea. You know, it doesn't seem to be...
Dominic Cummings' mantra was fund the NHS, hang the pedos.
Right.
Which also, actually, probably in this case, would be extremely popular with people. One of the things that's interesting about the opposition parties, though, is I think they're quite keen to have the focus stay on Mandelson, because then it's just purely a Labour scandal. And I'm not sure it is purely a Labour scandal. So there's an appearance by the Reform Treasurer, Nick Candy. Is there not in the files?
Yes, there is. I mean, again, one of these casual references that turned up in the files. And Nick Candy says that he and his brother bought this building.
Not just any building, we should say. Is this One Hyde Park?
This is indeed One Hyde Park. But that was the subject of a an appearance in court by Nick Candy in which he said he didn't buy it with his brother. His brother bought it. And it was wrong to say that he'd bought it because he just provided various services, which is a bit awkward.
He was the interior decorator, wasn't he? Yeah,
that
had great implications for the tax that they paid or didn't pay.
It right. did. Hmm. And I mean, who's to know? Is this email in the Epstein files right, or is what he said in court under oath right? I mean, don't look at me. I have no eye for these things.
I do think there's a bit of a principle in political life that when Nigel Farage is even slightly quiet for half an hour, you should look extremely carefully at what he's being quiet about, because he has been, he has made a fair few points about this, but he has kept a little bit quiet because his chief money man is now involved in this too.
Yeah, I mean, relatively tangentially, but I think the other thing for his point of view is that Donald Trump doesn't like a lot of focus on this, and he's very keen to preserve that relationship.
Why could that be?
Who could possibly say? The author of the quote in New York Magazine, Jeffrey likes a lot of women and he likes them on the young side. Another person who simply didn't know what was going on.
No idea.
Just
absolutely
no idea,
idea
at yeah, all. Yeah.
Oh, I feel ill. I feel iller than a lot of the correspondents who wrote into the letters page of The Eye this week saying that cover made me feel sick to my stomach. You redacted the wrong bit when you covered up Nitti's face.
Yes, no, and a lot of people said it put me off by breakfast. Some of our less busy readers said it put me off by lunch. But I think we may be near an apology for that cover.
To underpants, to the concept of underpants in general.
The only people to pay consequences is going to be you and Keir Starmer. It's a funny old world, isn't it?
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So those are some of the side cases that haven't received maybe the attention that they deserve. Maybe we should now come back to the... I'm afraid you said, you know, it's all about who's up, who's down, but it does have big political effects, this story. You know, there's a huge hunt on at the moment for anyone who thought appointing Mandelson was a good idea, because they mysteriously, they've all remembered that actually they thought this was a terrible idea all along.
Yes, the least subtle of which I thought was David Lammy. David Lammy was always against this, say sources close to David Lammy over the weekend. Good that sources close to David Lammy got that out there.
Yeah.
Took the time. But
if this does, and again, we're recording this before, I think, probably 24 hours of quite febrile news before you hear it, but if this does lead to the sense that Keir Starmer, you know, his position is untenable, then there are all sorts of people wondering who might be next. But there seem to be all sorts of problems with everyone else as well.
The problem is, so Angela Rayner, bastion of the soft left, now been on the back benches, you know, which has given her a lot of time to network, has still got the tax investigation, her second home declaration hanging over her. So, she, you know, that might put a pause on some people. Some people want Ed Miliband back, and that's because they were apparently asleep during the period 2010 to 2015.
A proven vote loser is what we need now.
I will say he was right on Mandelson when he was asked about it in 2010. He said, I think it's important to preserve the concept of dignity in retirement. And I think that was
okay, that was a banger.
One of the few sensible things that has been said about
Mandelson. I was hoping he said dignitas in retirement. No, that would have been extreme.
No, I mean, Ed Miliband has had a renaissance, an ednaissance, if you will, in that climate change brief. But I don't think there are that many people who remember his time as leader of the Labour Party with fond affection.
I don't think he does. I don't think he
was. No, he hated it. Yeah, yeah. He said everyone just kept going on about how he'd stabbed his brother in the back. And the problem with that was he had stabbed his brother in the back, and it was entirely fair to go on about it. And then Wes Streeting, who's seen as the kind of great hope of the Labour right, whatever you might call it, is friends, has long time been friends with
Peter's friends.
Much more connected with Peter Mandelson than Starmer was ever personally, isn't he?
Yeah, his partner Joe Dancy worked for Mandelson at one point. There was a suggestion in the Times that they were on Mandelson's stag do, which is a concept I would like to investigate more at greater length, because I wonder what that involved now. Sort of heady mixture of strippers and leaking fiscal briefings in a limo on the Brighton seafront.
Stripped him of his trousers, put him on the cover of Private Eye. Yeah.
Happened to anyone. So there is, you know, that's the kind of the holding pattern, really, is that it's not perfect timing for any of the other people to move. Andy Burnham obviously denied his ability to run in the Gorton by-election, so has at the moment no route to becoming Labour leader, unless he could get Keir Starmer to very quickly ennoble him and do it from the Lords. But that's probably not going to happen.
Well, there will be a seat going begging, won't there?
Well, that's true. There's a bench. There's an ermine free after Lord Mansfield.
But the vetting will now take much, much longer, because they'll have to take that much more seriously. So it might be quite difficult to turn around in the time. Can I come back to my point with Wes Streeting, which I keep banging on about because everyone else seems to forget? He's got a majority of 528 in Ilford. I mean, there's a really, really strong possibility that at the next general election he will be out.
What happens if you are the leader and then the Prime Minister and then you lose your seat? I know it never happens.
Well, you can't be Prime Minister. Well, the last person that got close to happening was Jo Swinson. Anyone remember her?
Yeah.
Lib Dem leader in the 2017 election, was this? Yeah.
Mm. She went out in one and then back in again in another, yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so she was out as leader, you know, of that
you just
morning.
Can't do it.
So
yeah,
I mean,
you just can't.
If your party has got the majority, which would be quite questionable at the moment for Labour, but and your leader loses their seat, then you've got a bit of a problem.
But I know I'm a broken record on this, but I don't know there really are that many safe seats anymore. If you look at Jo Swinson being a very good example, that SNP post Indy referendum 2015 tidal wave of yellow was extraordinary. Kirkcaldy used to be the safest seat, Gordon Brown's old seat, safest seat, and that went to SNP. You know, just the swings were vast. And I think that same thing could happen at the next election here. I don't know anyone whose seat looks, you know, nailed on, essentially.
Farage?
I mean, the thing is, it will be trending in his direction, right? That's the thing. Maybe I should modify that and say any Labour MP with a majority under 20,000 should be thinking, should put a bit of a shift in at the constituency surgery.
Yeah. Is there no holding candidate?
What, as in the sort of like the kind of when they have a pope and they pick a really old one and then they just go, well, give us another 6 months, we'll have a think about this. You can tell that things are happening because there was a very brief moment of excitement where someone seems to have briefed a lot of lobby reporters. Maybe it'll be Al Carnes.
Now,
and I know the first question on your lips, which is
who is Al Carnes?
Think of him very much as Labour's Mel Stride.
Brilliant.
He's not Labour's Mel Stride.
And who's Mel Stride?
Shadow Chancellor.
Thank you.
Of course.
But, he's financial spice.
Yeah. I fear that Al Carnes might have had a similar, had one drink with a journalist in which he went, well, you know, if the ball came loose from the back of the scrum. Mm. And this has become a very brief, you know, Carnes mania. But we'll see. Maybe by the time we finish recording this podcast, he'll be our Prime Minister.
You're right.
The joke will be on me. The thing I think will happen is that the party will snap back, like very much like Lord Mandelson's knicker elastic, to its default state, which is kind of soft left. So that's where
as in comfort zone stuff.
Yeah, but that's where the gravity of the PLP is. So Shabana Mahmood has put through immigration reforms that are probably broadly popular with the country at large, very unpopular with the MPs, very unpopular with the membership. The composition of the membership has changed since 2020 because quite a lot of them have left to join the Greens for a start, but it's still in where you'd expect to be socially liberal, pro-European. So Wes Streeting, for example, has been talking up his pro-European credentials because he knows in other respects on sort of cultural issues, he's more in the Blairite, the hated Blairite zone. You know, whereas Angela Rayner is, for example, has extremely strong links with trade unions, which are traditionally a very good thing when one is standing for the Labour leadership. But there's sort of something for all of those involved. This is not the ideal time for them to move, essentially. And so, yeah, I think that even as late as last week, the suspicion had been that something would happen after the May local elections. And that's why Anna Sawa has put that distance, because he is facing the SNP. In what is expected to be a pretty brutal battle up in Scotland. and he wants to put a bit of distance from himself in the way that Douglas Ross distanced himself from the unpopular Boris Johnson in England. You know, that's always been, ever since the rows, actually, to go back to the Miliband era, about whether or not the SNP, the Scottish Labour leader, is the kind of leader of a branch office or a fully fledged leader in their own right. It has been a really difficult thing when the party in power, like the centre, the Westminster leader of Labour, is unpopular. What do you do as the regional leaders? And the Welsh Labour will be having exactly that discussion too, because again, they're expecting to lose their majority in the Senedd for the first time, you know, ever. They won't be the biggest party in Wales since, you know, for the first time since devolution. So there's a big incentives for people in the regions and nations to kind of, in the same way that there is for Andy Burnham, to say, actually, I'm getting off this sinking ship, thanks.
I guess there's big incentives as well for people kind of nationally who are possible contenders for the prime ministership to kind of not want to take on, when that's going to be your immediate thing, is a very difficult by-election up in Manchester, and then those local election results. It's kind of like, yeah, no, Keir, you have those, and then that's a much better point at which to come in a very cynical way, isn't it?
Yeah, and also the one thing that has plagued the Starmer administration is the perceived and indeed actual lack of a plan. You know, the very panicky winter fuel allowance, oh no we're not, PIP reform, oh no we're not, you know, well, no we're not going to raise taxes, okay we'll get through these sneaky ones instead. That actually, which of the other candidates has got a kind of, have they already got in place a fully formed, like, what do they think the problems are with Britain, and how would they solve them, and how would they get the rest of the parliamentary Labour Party to vote for those solutions? That's Luke Trill does a lot of, from More in Common, he does a lot of focus group polling, and he said the emotion he sees now is not apathy, but nihilism. People just think everything is screwed and they don't think anyone can fix it. And I think that is also a bit of an inhibition on some of the candidates too.
And that's what your initial point is, why this scandal may have bigger repercussions than it should have, is because people feel so badly about politicians. And this plays into the narrative, well, look at that. It couldn't get worse than that, could it? What we all believed is true. None of them are any good.
Yeah, what does Britain's future look like? I'm off to California next week, and say what you like about California.
It's good, permanent, yeah.
It's not always bloody raining, and actually people are excited about the future. You know, there's a sense that things are actually changing and the world is improving, and there's, you know, yes, they're all on mad peptides and, you know, sort of worrying about the Antichrist, but at least, like, that's quite a classy problem to have, the Antichrist. Our problem is, like, chronic low productivity and a, you know, welfare dependency ratio that's really troublesome. So I think that's, you know, I just think there is a that pervasive sense of sort of doom.
Well,
refuse to share.
We've reached our traditional cheerful point to end on, so I think we should wrap it up there.
Yeah, sorry. It's all right for me, I'll be in California.
Well, that's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again in a fortnight with another one. In the meantime, Private Eye is available on newsstands, but if you don't want people to see you carrying around a picture of Peter Mandelson in his Y-fronts, you can get a subscription, which is delivered to you, I know because I've got one, in a plain envelope. Hide your shame. For very, very reasonable prices. private-eye.co.uk. It's all there. until then, thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. And thanks, as always, to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Bye for now.